welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. My name is Nathaniel Schooler, and I am your host. Thanks for tuning in. Well, it's lovely to be joined by so many great experts in technology, and Nish is helping me to host this this series. Kim hopefully will be joining us, but welcome to both of you, all three of you. It's lovely that you took the time to join us, and we're going to talk about all sorts of people related technology problems, I think, today. And what do you think, Toby? Is it big problem for you, people and technology?
People in technology is, it's 95% of technology is really people. We often forget in technology that we build platforms for people to achieve outcomes. And so people are absolutely critical to everything about technology.
So I just have to unmute my microphone there. So how about you, JD? What do you think? Is people and technology, does it cause like massive problems for you or for companies?
It's not the people causing the problems. It is the fact that we develop and deploy technology significantly faster than we educate and enable people to work with it in an optimal and secure way. So that knowledge gap, that experience gap, the mindset gap, the skill set and mindset gap we see between the pace of technology and the pace in how we educate people, that is the problem. But the people themselves, nobody wants to go home and say, well, I did a lousy job today, right?
Of course. So would you mind just telling everybody what background you have in technology, JD, before I move on to Toby, if that's all right?
Well, my background started in applied information technology, which I promoted in, and then very fast considered boring because you keep doing the same things. That was my view. And I also got infected with this desire to help people become better at using technology. So that's where I started. I went through all kinds of corporate roles in that area. And some 5 years ago, I decided to go on my own, founded my company, Spearhead Management, and started working on the human element in cybersecurity. It's a publication you can find on my website. It's education programs, et cetera, et cetera. And since the beginning of this year, I joined WeDo as a CISO and DPO. It's a fast-growing platform. We're building a fantastic community. And I want to make sure that we do that in the right way. So for me, it's now my chance to show that all the experience I have and all the lessons I learned to other people, that I can also implement them myself.
Super. Well, thank you. And how about you, Toby? I know you've founded lots and lots of companies over the last sort of 15 years. Where did you sort of start in tech and where are you now?
So my journey in technology started at 12 years old, breaking printer drivers and an old LNX laptop. If you remember Pentium 1 and 166, that's where my foundation started many years ago. From there, I grew into an information security role, primarily in designing networks as part of a government division, and then was seated in various positions around the world working for elements of government departments. From then, yes, I've seeded, founded and grown a number of internet service providers, all with different boutique elements, some working in high growth content media, some working in sort of global elastic fabrics, and I work with and scale up a number of private cloud businesses as well. So my background is very much in information security, but from a networking engineering angle.
Super. And I know, Nish, you're involved with lots of projects as well, aren't you? And in digital transformation and stuff like that. And I know you're dying to answer the question about people and technology. So go for it.
I've not got a huge amount of experience in security, but there is an absolute, every single job that I've done, every single technology that I've implemented, which is what brings me here to this series, it is all to do with, I have a very firm belief and ethos is in that you can build as fantastic technology as you want, but if you don't do the necessary process to land that with the people who are using it, then you basically built nothing, because it is people that have to use the technology that you're implementing. And I've seen like $100 million budgets be cut to $2 million, be cut to zero, because people weren't able to deliver technologies to the satisfaction of the end user. It is the making or breaking of technology budgets, and it has been for the last, 10, 15, 20 years. So it is a problem to crack, and it should always be factored into delivery processes. The people element has to be considered, as well as a people psychology element to all technology projects, is what I've seen. And across this whole series, it didn't really matter who we've spoken to. We're now talking about network security, cybersecurity, and everybody says the same thing. It's this whole element of enabling people to utilize what it is that you're developing and what you're creating or deploying. And I'd be interested to find out, if you don't mind me asking the next question, Nat,
please do.
Toby, your experience in government, I'd be interested to find out how that plays out in that sector, actually, because historically for me, and maybe this is just some ignorance, I always thought that government sector is a little bit behind in technology. And I'd be interested to find out how it's landed for you yourself, bringing new technologies into that environment, how it's been in terms of the people journey that you've had to take people on.
Sure. So in my experience, there's a massive divide. There are some incredibly smart initiatives and incredibly bright minds at the very forefront of that development cycle. They really are at ground level, incubating technologies, building platforms. They have a finger very acutely on the pulse. And at the back of the process is an organization, effectively, that does want to move in the right direction. They understand the requirement for change, and they understand the gaps that are there. The trouble that a larger division, such as a government department, has is trying to bridge that gap. And you're talking about tens of thousands of people here. It's a complex organization. Whereas at a private entity, you can divisionalize and appoint managers and leaders to carve that down. You don't have the same levels of flexibility in a government department. So in my experience, what I have seen is that people do adopt the change. They want to promote the change. They understand the gaps. But there is this huge void in the center of a government department where people need to fall into that. And I think the reason that doesn't happen is because of a skill set shortage, and because of a lack of cultural incubation and the right thought processes and training people how to become better people in that part of the business as such.
Yeah. There's a massive, massive gap, right? Like I've been sort of studying a little bit about cybersecurity over the years myself. And, we were talking about this before, weren't we, JD, and how there's like some sort of massive skill gap. We were all talking about it, and how, basically the technology, I mean, you put it rather eloquently. You said we develop technology faster than we educate people, was sort of what you said. And I think absolutely it's a tricky one though, isn't it? Because it's almost like HR needs to turn around and be more involved in the sort of structure within that environment, right? But actually they're not, are they? They're sort of like over there working in a silo, when actually they need to be more involved, really,
Yeah, I think we need to reflect on two things. On the one side, we have an enormous bottleneck at the moment in cybersecurity experts, specifically, and in IT specialists in general. That bottleneck is not going to go away by sending people on a social event or a team working event or such things. That is going to go away if we make very important changes in the structures of how we educate those people, but also at how we select people. We don't need 5 master degrees and 20 years of experience for all the tasks that we have, but we are looking for those people. There's a wonderful concept of boot camps where you send a group of people and they get a boot camp training of 2-3 weeks for very specific specialized tasks. You bring them back in the organization and they perform those tasks because you have a backlog there. And after 3 months, maybe they're done with that big project. Well, send them to the next bootcamp. Bring them the new skills and don't look for the universal soldiers all the time with the high qualifications and the many years of experience. Because, yes, you need them at a certain level, but you don't need them everywhere. But what we also need to look at, the people already in the organization, the IT expert, the cybersecurity expert, what is their current workload? How much pressure do they get? How much education opportunities do they actively get? How well are they trained for the technology they are actively managing and deploying? We see enormous gaps there. So that bottleneck has two significant consequences. One is the people now in the industry are not getting enough time to do the things they should be doing and to educate and prepare themselves for everything that is coming. And second impact is that because we have not enough people and a growing amount of responsibilities, we're just building bigger problems. And if we're not changing that, it's going to hurt us big.
Yeah. So what do you think, Nish? Have you got a good question up your sleeve? I know you like a good question.
Yeah, so I was actually, so I've been watching the background flash up behind you, JD, and I'm interested to find out for yourself. So you mentioned, you told us a lovely story about your daughter, and I'm interested to find out, along this thread of technology being developed faster than we can educate people on how best to use it, one of the biggest use cases for that for me is social media. And this idea that was developed and organically created and then just became this behemoth that is now really ingrained in our society today. And you know, you yourself have a 15-year-old, and I've always, when I look at my life and how it's going to move forward, and my biggest fear is how would, if I'm ever blessed with a child, how would I engage in that debate? Like, so social media is not going anywhere. What is your view on the level of engagement that you allow for your teenage daughter with that sort of hat on of security and cybersecurity in that space? Because we know, the world didn't evolve fast enough really to actively put those checks and balances in place when social media is around, and that's created a whole slew of problems. So I'd be interested to find out your view on this.
Well, let me start with a little anecdote. I was preparing a security training, and my daughter, when she was little, she was always very interested in what are you doing, and she wanted to watch and she wanted to see. And so I told her what I'm doing, and she was like, "Oh, what do you mean?" And at that moment, she confronted me with all my knowledge. Doesn't make any sense for kids because they think completely different. They have completely different usage. And that made me think about how can we help kids understand the stuff that most adults have issues with understanding. And that initiated the project Internet Safety for Kids, which I'm doing now for many years with a lot of experts supporting us. We built an international platform. But the foundation is a curious kid wanting to know what I'm doing, and I'm not able to actually explain it in a way that she understands. So we took that, and I quickly found a lot of parents and a lot of teachers who really want to help those kids but don't have the right instruments themselves as well. And we started working on what is important. Well, the first thing that is important is that we need to change our thinking when we talk to kids and when we help them understand what is good and what is not good. I use the example of photography. When I take my vantage point and take a picture of a kid, you will always have this stupid kid picture where the kid is looking upwards because I'm taller and my camera is up there. When I go down on my knees, put myself at the same level of that same kid, and I then take a picture of that kid, now suddenly the kid is involved in the picture. The kid is looking in the camera. You see the face, you see the expression, you see, and you no longer have this stupid looking up, right? That is when you want to explain something, much more complicated than you can imagine. And what we developed is basically two things. One is educate the parents. Because as soon as we start talking to the kids, and we do that a lot to test the program and to improve it, kids are still telling us interesting things. They say, yeah, you tell us that we need to tell our parents what we want to do on our mobile phone or on computer. And so they understand, but they never have time. When I come up with my new game and I want to show it to my father says, no, show me tomorrow. Or, yeah, it's fine. But you told us that we should explain it. So we need to educate the parents. That's one thing. And the second thing we learned is when you actually explain it to children, why it is important to not share your mobile phone number everywhere, to not share pictures of your family everywhere, they become very involved and they start really understanding that. But then suddenly parents get confronted with kids 5 times a day asking, can I share this? Well, you have to take time for that. You have to reward them from that. You should not say, I don't have time for that. And that's a challenge. And then we learned interesting ways of explaining kids. We explain privacy with the example of a toilet. And kids love it. We say, well, it's a toilet, and you have to go to the toilet. So you go to the toilet, but unfortunately, it's in the middle of the street. It's in a big shopping mall. Everybody can see you. You don't like that. You don't have privacy. What you want is a toilet where you can close the door and nobody can see you. There are no cameras. And you can go to the toilet undisturbed. That is privacy. Now, if you want that, you also have to accept that everybody else wants to go to their own toilet. So don't put people on the toilet in the middle of a shopping mall where everybody can see them. And kids go, oh, right, that makes sense. When you start forbidding them things, they find ways to do it anyway.
Yeah.
When you show them why some things should not be done, and you help them understand that that is best for them and for their friends and their family, they become involved. Most of the time, not always. Sometimes you have to remind them and sometimes you have to negotiate. But it works when you explain it in a way that they understand. And then you don't have to look that much at restrictions or all the risk, because they come to you and ask you questions. The war in Ukraine, which is horrible, the educated kids who have understood the program are sending us messages asking, what should they look at? How can they see if it's true or not? Things like that. So they do, and they want to, and they're really involved. You just have to help them with communication, which they understand.
Yeah. I think also being understanding that actually they're smarter than you think, right? And actually, you know, if you explain why, like you said, in a simple terms, then they actually are much smarter than you think. And actually, we worry about, you know, predators and this and that, but actually it's not really about the predators as much as it is, in my opinion, as much as it is about the access to applications, bullying from friends, yeah, bullying from people who aren't their friends. Like, it's a whole conversation. We should do it. We'll do another interview sometime and have a long conversation about it, because it's just massive, right? Like, it's never ending, the child problem with privacy and everything else, you know. It's just huge. But don't panic, Nish, it'll be okay. Yeah.
We got already 20 videos for you. 20 videos for you are available, so you can practice.
She's getting married soon, you see, so she's making preparations for 5 years down, 10 years down the line, right? Fantastic. I love that. It's fantastic. So I'm going to jump in there, really, and sort of just mix things up a little bit, right? So, Toby, I know you're working on like loads of really cool, like new tech. Yeah. So what interests you the most about like the latest tech that's out there? Like, what's exciting for you at the moment?
Being honest, it's having absolutely no idea what's coming next. So we're in a really unique and interesting period in time in technology, and technology always moves faster than we can educate people. But also, when you're in an internet startup or you're in the scale-up technical organization, you're so in the moment in that current new technology. By the time you're 6 months in, something else is coming through. I mean, the simple analogy for that is looking at blockchain. Look back 10 years ago, even longer than that. We knew it was there and it was a thing. And all of a sudden, the last 24, 36 months, we've all gone, oh my God, what was that? And it has been there for a long time. People are slow to adopt it and slow to recognize it. So, you know, one of the critical things that we try and do in technical startups is be acutely aware that we right now are on the tip of an iceberg, but there's another one coming, and we can see it in the distance right now, but I can't see it clearly enough to understand quite what it is yet or how to deal with it. Bringing that back to the culture and people piece of that, what we look for are people that are highly adaptable. So we need to understand that the generalist skill set supports certain technological developments, but you can't have a specialist for something that doesn't exist yet. And trying to forecast for that and embrace that as a technical organization is really what gets me out of bed in the morning. It's exciting right now. There's so much innovation going on. We're bridging this gap all the time between software and hardware. Embedded systems are getting closer and closer and closer. And now we're finding new ways to exchange information and to take, you know, full use of platforms such as blockchain. We're building a security first platform that is solely based on blockchain as a fully encrypted network operator. It's never been done before. So, you know, I think at the moment, and certainly for the foreseeable future, we are in a period of rapid technical change and rapid incubation of brand new technologies that we are only just beginning to understand how to utilize.
Yeah. I was talking, I think last week or the week before, about like this productivity curve that we're just at the beginning of, right? Because everyone's like, who's really into productivity? For the past few years, they haven't really had that much amazing stuff in tech, right? But now, like, with all the writing tech that's out there, with, yeah, you know, the way that you can like integrate things, like I can't wait to see kind of the next few years or even months of how fast these things are gonna kind of move forwards, really, to be honest. And, you know, it's fascinating, right? But you can't be an expert in everything. Like, there is so much going on that it is so vast that I think, you know, keeping your specialty is really, really crucial, no doubt about it, you know. And medicine as well, like, is a big one for me. So what about you, JD? What are you really interested in at the moment in technology?
Well, for me, the most important development at this moment is that we see technology coming that is going to add to sustainability, that is going to actually find solutions for things like climate change. That is one thing I'm very, very excited about. On the other hand, we see that what we have seen in the past 3 to 5 years is this hype wave of everything new, right? Blockchain was going to cure cancer, and 5G was going to solve all the connectivity problems and all those things. That is decreasing, fortunately. There's no longer this somebody comes up with a popular hashtag and then everybody's going to make predictions about whatever it's going to. We learned a little bit from that phase, maybe because we have other problems to deal with, like the pandemic and war and climate change. So that is also something what I'm excited about, because now that big noise is gone and we are focusing again on what the real opportunities of technology is. And one of the great opportunities of blockchain, for example, is the encryption is embedded in the data. There's no data without encryption. There's no encryption without data. And we're generating a factor 10 times more data per 6 months at the moment. So yes, please. But now in blockchain, we are also focusing on the efficiency of blockchain, which has been a huge, huge, huge problem in the past. But because we were so excited about how it was going to solve every problem, we stopped focusing on improving blockchain. And that improvement is currently happening. So if we continue in this space, 2 to 3 years from now, we have actually learned how to build blockchain platforms that are as efficient, energy efficient, as standard cloud platforms. And then we add all the benefits, like smart contract, embedded encryption. I mean, quantum computing is going to have a huge problem with good blockchain platforms. And by the time quantum computing becomes something we can throw around, then, well, blockchain is quantum as well. So we still have all the benefits of that. And that's what I am excited about. We're focusing now on reality and no longer on the hypes.
Exactly. Exactly. And a lot of these technologies like VR and AR, like they've been around for a long, long time now, right? So now we're just getting to the stage where they're becoming, you know, a real market, right? And that with gaming and everything else is going to, it's going to create so many jobs in the world as well. Like I've got a friend that's running a podcast about gaming, and he's talking to all sorts of people like over in Africa and, you know, her, just creating jobs, like, right? I mean, that's what we want, right? Like, this is what we want, is to change the world. And with 48% of the world still without technology, without access to the internet, right? Like, if we can change that, we can just help so many people. And that excites me as well. So what about you, Nish? What are you excited about? I know we talked about this last week as well.
Yeah, so There's a few areas that I'm interested in. I think the biggest thing for me is medical technology and the ability to potentially, you know, have people have medications that are tailored to themselves, or vitamin packages and things like that are tailored to themselves. The other thing you mentioned, JD, is sustainability technology, the advancement of electric vehicles, for example, and how, you know, I think there's currently, it's not necessarily the most carbon neutral to make an electric car, but, you know, the advances in technology that will bring and how, you know, that will advance our society in terms of limiting climate change. All of that sort of, all of those things, technology to the advancement of the human race is probably what I'm really interested in, and what is really floating my boat at the moment, I suppose, where I can put my hat on and say, yeah, I'm a technologist, I work in technology, and I'd love to you know, get into projects which actually move that you know, movement forward. The other thing is, you mentioned productivity. I think over the last couple of years, we've also realized that we are a remote community, a remote society. Like, I remember over the pandemic doing quizzes with people, and like a massive 10 people quiz with people all over the world, and bringing people together using technology. And that was just on a Saturday morning at 2 o'clock. I think we had people from Iran and, you know, South Africa and Australia. And it's that idea of, you know, we can be connected, even like, and that was all through the advancement of technology. Even small educational pieces like teaching, we've talked about it a lot here, actually, in that, teaching your parents how to use Zoom. You know, I actually had a Zoom the other day with my mum, just because she knows how to use it now, you know. So bringing people together like that, our team in fact is a completely remote team. We do all of our contracts remotely, and what that will do for the workplace culture and productivity as a whole, that is, we're in an interesting period at the moment where I think just today I was chatting with some people about, you know, management decisions and workplace culture decisions that have to be made around flexible working, people gaining more time for themselves and realizing what productivity means to them, working less and spending more time on themselves, and any technology that can advance that through productivity tools, through you know, video conferencing tools, anything that moves that forward is also something that is very exciting to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think giving everyone, you know, a real life, and actually them being able to work when they want, from where they want, for as long as they want, it enables more control, right? I'm not saying everyone has to work 10 hours a week, 20 hours a week, but I'm saying that it should be more of a choice, right? Like, you know, I appreciate in the early stages of a business, you know, you need to work considerable amount of hours, right? But once you get that business to a certain level, you can just hire a team of people. You don't need to work that many hours, and that becomes quite exciting. The whole prospect of having more leisure time, having what they promised us at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, right? Like I've been talking about this for ages. Everyone's like, well, we're in number three. It's like, well, not really. We're still in Industrial Revolution number one, just because some tech analyst, nothing personal. I used to be a tech analyst, right? But like a lot of them love talking about like these concepts, but in fact, they're not new. Like they've been around for, since we came out with mechanized farming, right? Like, it just makes me smile, really, to be honest. So what do you think, Toby? Are you sick of people coming up with all of these concepts and driving you a bit mad or what?
I think ideas people are absolutely critical to the ongoing evolution of technology. And we've got to constantly try and build new things that constantly go wrong to learn from them. And we see that all the time right now. And what JD was saying about the evolution there of biotechnology's effect and sustainable technologies and the blockchain crypto marketplaces currently, and we're seeing that evolution, and we built these technologies that require enormous amounts of compute power. That's now led people to develop that further into having the same outcome with less energy input. So we have to constantly throw these new ideas up in the air to try and find one that will stick, and then we'll find 10 more of them and throw them up in the air. And that's, I think, how the rapid pace of innovation is happening currently. What's different in the current situation is more people are throwing more things up in the air. It's so much easier, and these new technical platforms are so much more accessible for people now because we have things like remote working, and we have that culture behind that too. That accessibility piece is really key, and that's driving this rapid pace of innovation currently, in my view.
Very interesting. Yeah, I agree completely. The more work that we put in, the faster we're going to get somewhere, right? I mean, that's where it is, really. So what do you think? What do you think, JD, on this, on the innovation side of things? Do you think we're kind of at a good place with that, or?
Well, the two things that we have done in the past few years, we have developed an ecosystem and toolbox where others can innovate. Before that, it was that the people creating technology are the ones who were innovating. Now we have created cloud ecosystems, AI-driven ecosystems. You can shop and you can pick all the components that you need to build your own solutions and become creative with that and innovative with that. And the pace of bringing new items into those ecosystems has increased significantly. So we are much more capable to innovate, and we have reduced the cost and the impact of that innovation. So more and more people, we don't know where the next Einstein is, but we also know if we give that new Einstein the tools and the connectivity to do whatever he or she wants, whenever he or she wants that, we're not getting one new Einstein, we're going to get hundreds and thousands of new Einsteins. Right. If you just look at what Elon Musk has done, and you don't have to agree with all his statements, but just look at what he has done. He has built a car company against all the odds, but also against all the concepts. He has built a rocket launching company against the odds and against all the concepts. You can challenge the Boring Company if it makes sense or not. But he's doing it. And he's doing that because he's driven by whatever drives him. But he's also willing to put his money and his knowledge on the table. I'm told recently that until he was trying to buy Twitter, he has never sold any of his stock unless he was selling his entire company. So he's putting his own money on the plate. And he's driving innovation in a significantly faster pace than we have done that before. Now, a 12-year-old boy in India or in Africa or in Germany or in the UK is looking at all that and thinks, when he can do it, I can try it as well. And a smart girl being told that she has no place in tech because girls have to cook and clean house and whatever, she can now go online, watch a bunch of tutorials how she can code, and without a lot of cost, she can start coding her own programs. That wasn't possible 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
I think that those changes are driving innovation much faster than anything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I like that a lot. So, Nish, what do you think before we wrap up?
I think, you bring up a really good point. I think that it is all about sort of role modeling the next generation of technologists, and this idea that, there is a huge, still a bit of a gap in, women in STEM subjects. I know from recent experience, trying to get women into our development team is just is almost impossible, if I can almost say so, as something that we've been actually driving towards quite significantly. Having recruiters find that particular talent pool is like finding a complete needle in a haystack. And it's just that idea of, like you say, there's just more, it just brings more opinions to the table. It brings more more perspectives, and then it rounds off a technology solution in a way that is a little bit more human than if you just had one perspective, one type of person making a program. So I think that that's a really interesting point about different types of people that come into it. You mentioned people from different backgrounds, poor people in Africa or in India, or rich people in Africa and India getting into these subjects and doing these things. Everyone comes with their own baggage and their own experiences, and it means that becoming role models to these people and inspiring them to take up a technology role or technology path, then they will inherently enhance our future technology offerings because of just inherently where they've come from, and they'll build things for the people that they have seen, the people from where they have come from. So if we can get developments, you mentioned that as well before, like getting more technology into those communities that don't have it, building micro ecosystems or micro economies within small villages, all of those sorts of technologies are also important to the furthering of I'd say humanity. It feels like a little bit loaded, but that's where it feels like it's going, really.
Well, thank you, Nish. And thanks, Toby. Thank you, JD. Appreciate you guys. I think we'll get have some more interviews, hopefully, in the next couple months. Thanks for listening.
Thanks very much for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen.